Stand by for the fastest 60 minutes in Jewish radio. It's time for the Jewish Experience. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. And just for a month that has no holidays, the month of Cheshvan, called Mar Cheshvan, in fact, we just celebrated three birthdays in a 10-day period in the DeLynn household. Hi, I'm Hirsch DeLynn, your host, and you are tuned in to Pittsburgh's only Jewish radio program, The Jewish Experience. You know, your birthday is a very important day for the world. Did you know that for your sake, the world was created? Yeah, it's big stuff. On your birthday, you have a special strength to give brachas or blessings to your friends and family and should spend your day reflecting on your past and even resolving to do better in your future. Some have a custom, of course, to recite Tehillim or Psalms throughout the day. So it's a big day. So next time you have a birthday, don't pass it up. Use it. Parsha this week is Chaye Sarah, the life of Sarah, and it actually speaks about her death at the ripe age of 127. When Sarah died, Abraham sent his servant Eliezer to Haran to find a wife for Yitzchak. He gets a sign from God that Rivka, who demonstrated such chesed by watering his camels, should be the wife for Yitzchak. So he took out gifts and jewelry and gave them to Rivka. He then proceeds to Rivka's father's house, asks for her hand in marriage for his boss, and she agrees. And when they return to Canaan, Yitzchak is praying in the field. And then he goes ahead and marries Rivka, and she became his wife, and then he loved her. Note the order. First, he marries her, and then she has to want to become his wife, and then he loves her. Well, what do we see in today's secular society? People first become infatuated and think they're in love, then they get married, then 45% of them find out after the infatuation wears off that they can't live with the person, usually because they married him for the wrong reasons. This is yet another crucial lesson from Torah that, if followed, would make for a much better and much more fulfilling marital life. And speaking of marriage, our staff is married to this show, bringing you quality Jewish radio with Musical Moish, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, Rabbi Yosef Eisen, and Mr. Vordelin. So sit back and enjoy 60 minutes of the best Jewish radio in Pennsylvania. We'll have your community announcements and mazel tovs, of course, along with current news fresh from Israel National Radio coming up on the half hour. Special guest this week is Dr. Alex Grobman, a historian and author of Nations United, who will be in Pittsburgh November 8th. And he's going to be speaking on international anti-Semitism, so stay with us for that. And if you haven't sponsored a segment yet, of course you can step up and do it now. Everybody tells us how much they love the show and they like to hear us on every week. Well, it takes some resources to do that, and we need your help. So we want to continue to bring you the best and only authentic Jewish radio in Pittsburgh, but we've got to have your support, so please. Give us a call, 412-979-5770 or jewishexperience@verizon.net. You can, of course, sponsor your favorite segment, Rabbi Goldwasser's Torah Lesson, the story segment, community news and announcements, the feminine perspective, Rabbi Eisen's Moment in Jewish History. So it's got something for everybody, and it's actually inexpensive to do it, so call right now and reserve your spot. As always, we thank our regular sponsors. Thank God for them. Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, Next Generation Financial Services, First Mariner Bank, Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, and Artistic Photography. Don't forget to ask for a special gift of a beautiful refrigerator magnet that is yours free. Is free when you call us at 412-979-5770, or you can send us an email at jewishexperience@verizon.net. Now we get candlelighting time tonight, and we backed out of the sixes. We're at 5:58 p.m.
Bye.
An insight on this week's Parsha is our resident rabbi, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser.
This week's Sedra contains the account of the journey of Eliezer, Avraham's servant, to Nochor to find the wife for Yitzchak. Eliezer chose Rivka and asked her parents' consent to take her back to Canaan to become Yitzchak's wife. He said to them, "And now, if you will deal kindly and truly with my master." Eliezer's words seem rather puzzling. He was asking Rivka's parents to show kindness to Avram by letting their daughter go with him. If they would perform this act of kindness, wouldn't this in itself be the best indication that they were dealing truly? Why then did Eliezer ask them to deal kindly and truly? If one acts kindly and charitably towards his fellow, do not his actions prove the truth and sincerity of his kindness? The answer to this question is, unfortunately, no. There is a wide gap between chesed, kindness, and emes, truth and sincerity. This will become clearer in the light of the following freely translated excerpts from the writing of some of the Rebbeim of Lubavitch. The great Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi taught his followers to critically examine their every action and see that it be sincere. The Friedrich Rebbe taught, "Some may think that true service of Hashem involves world-shaking action. In reality, however, every act and any deed is of utmost value and significance, provided it is performed with sincerity. For example, the simple act of uttering a bracha, but taking its meaning to heart, the words of prayer said as they ought to be said, with genuine feeling and emotion, and with the oneness that one is standing before the Almighty, studying a verse of Chumash with the realization that it is the word of Hashem, one verse of Tehillim, or this sincere display of love and affection towards one's fellow man. Of course, in order to attain this simple trait of sincerity, enormous effort and abundant Torah study is called for. In our own era, a great wall has been erected between Chesed and Emes. Chesed abounds, for today one is renowned for his good heartedness and generosity, but Emes is hard to find. There are many persons who are known for their acts of kindness, but when it comes to Emes, when they are asked to show Chesed in circumstances in which there is no opportunity for publicity, their response is often cooler. So wide is the gap between kindness and truth that the great Torah commentator Rashi maintains that sincere kindness is only to be found in such acts as are exemplified by honoring the dead. For since the recipient will never be able to repay him, he cannot be suspected of having any ulterior motive for his kindness. Nowadays, however, even in Rashi's classic case of Chesed Shel Emes, it is often difficult to know whether some are present to honor the dead or to please the living.
Retirement can be a wonderful reward for years of hard work, but it can also be stressful as you deal with questions about how to maintain your standard of living while protecting what you worked so hard for. What if I told you that you could generate extra cash flow without touching a penny of your savings, investments, or current income? If you or someone you love is 62 years or older and owns their own home, they may be able to take advantage of a federally regulated program called a home equity conversion mortgage or reverse mortgage. Seniors all across the U.S. are using reverse mortgages to increase their cash flow for purchasing long-term care insurance, putting grandkids through college, making charitable donations, paying off credit card debt, paying for prescription drugs, buying vacation homes, and paying for much-needed home repair. Call for a free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet today. Get the facts and help yourself and your family through a reverse mortgage. Call Andy at 412-562-2220 for a free copy while supplies last. Again, that number is 412-562-2220 for your free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet. First Mariner Bank is an equal housing lender.
Will Israel ever see an end to violence? How will the war against Iraq's insurgents impact Israel? Will changes on the Supreme Court have any effect on the Jewish community? Is anti-Semitism in Europe on the rise? What can be done about it? For a look behind the headlines, read the Forward, the nation's Jewish newspaper. The Forward reveals the personalities, motivations, and histories that are fueling the news abroad. The Forward also provides an in-depth look at issues affecting us at home, with comprehensive reports on everything from politics and religion to culture and the arts. It even has its own matchmaking section for Jewish singles. Try 4 weeks free, then be billed $24.95 for another 26 issues. Not satisfied? Just write cancel on the bill and keep the first four issues free.
Call now for The Forward, 800-992-3333. That's 800-992-3333. All around us, life is moving faster and faster. Things are changing all the time. And it's a comfort to know in your time of need that at Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, the Jewish tradition continues. Burton Hirsch Funeral Home has served the Pittsburgh Jewish community since 1947 and has recently remodeled its entire facility to better serve you. Burton Hirsch Funeral Directors are members of the Jewish Funeral Directors Association and work closely with area rabbis to ensure that your needs as a Jewish family are totally met. Their attentive and compassionate guidance results in treating each family as their own. I personally met with Michael Hilgefort. And did you know that Burton Hirsch Funeral Home is even involved with community educational programs to ensure that Jewish families know what to do to have a proper burial? In your time of special need, call Squirrel Hill's only Jewish funeral home, Burton Hirsch, at 412-521-2600. That's 412-521-2600. They welcome your request to visit and tour their state-of-the-art facilities. Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, proud sponsors of the Jewish Experience, 412-521-2600.
521-2600. Yoy Abraham Yoke, Yitzhak Yirane, Yaakov Ono, Hontuboy, Abraham Yoke, Yitzhak Yirane, Yaakov Ono, Hontuboy.
It's time for a moment in Jewish history with the author of Miraculous Journey, Rabbi Yosef Eisen.
Orthodox Jewry experienced enormous growth in the 1960s. Children of Holocaust survivors reached their teen years and young adulthood during this decade. Taking advantage of opportunities denied their parents, they swelled the yeshivas and Jewish schools, setting new standards for Torah excellence in America. Many of them became scholars and teachers, while even those who entered the general job market displayed a new pride and assertiveness in their observance, replacing the defensiveness of earlier generations of American Orthodox Jews. Lumping together diverse Orthodox groups that in Europe had little interaction, such as Hungarian Hasidim and Lithuanian Misnagdim, created a uniquely American cross-cultural fertilization that benefited both groups. Hasidic modes of dress, customs, and kosher standards began making inroads among Misnagdim, while the Lithuanian style of Talmudic study became more popular among Hasidim, especially those who attended Lithuanian-style yeshivos. It is interesting to note that in photographs of attendees of Lithuanian yeshivas in Europe, only the faculty wore dark garb and beards. The students dressed in light beige suits and hats and did not grow beards. The black hat of today's yeshiva student is a unique American innovation. Among the major Torah leaders in America were Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, the Satmar Rebbe, and the Rebbe of Lubavitch. Rabbi Aaron Kotler passed away in 1962. Three factors contributed to the rise of Jews brought up in a non-religious environment turning to Torah observance. First, the new emphasis at the end of the 60s on ethnic identity won Orthodox Jews a measure of respect. If African Americans could proudly display symbols of their ethnicity, could not Jews do the same? If one could wear a dashiki in public and eat soul food, why could one not wear a kippah and eat kosher food? Second, young Americans began turning away from the value system of their parents, which stressed material success, to lifestyles that satisfied their desire for inner meaning and self-discovery. Jews, who attended universities at 3 times the rate of the general population, were particularly susceptible to the winds of change swirling about them. While many idealistic young Jews were attracted to radical causes and Eastern religions, others found spiritual fulfillment in their own heritage. Third, many Jews, even those secularly oriented, viewed Israel's victory in the Six-Day War as miraculous. It strengthened their connection with the Jewish people and provided an impetus to explore Judaism as a lifestyle. While the numbers of returnees to Jewish observance was relatively small in the 1960s, the groundwork was laid for the many thousands of Jews who would discover their religion in later decades, both in the United States and in Israel. This is Rabbi Yosef Eisen wishing you a happy and healthy Shabbos.
Now, from the Israel National Radio Newsroom, here's Ernie Singer.
Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has told aides and foreign officials he intends to help American President George W. Bush meet his deadline for a new Arab state within Israel's current borders by the fall of 2008. President Bush has set the deadline, which coincides with the presidential elections in the United States, almost 3 months before he leaves office. Prime Minister Olmert has reasoned that Israel is better off with an agreement with the PLO while President Bush is in office, rather than have to deal with a different administration that may not be committed to Israel's retaining large population centers in Judea and Samaria. The PLO deploying 300 American trained security troops in Shechem this weekend. Their deployment is considered a test case for the PLO to prove that it can maintain law and order. The PLO is conducting widespread arrests of Hamas clerics in Judea and Samaria to prevent political dissent, according to the British Guardian. The crackdown follows the closure of Hamas-linked charities, several of which were raided by Israeli forces. Among those recently arrested were Sheikh Maher Haras, a prominent Hamas fundamentalist cleric. The PLO head of religious affairs in Shechem, Hassan Hilali, has defended the arrest as preventing preachers from changing the mosque into what he called something with a political identity or certain ideology or linked to a particular group or cult. His predecessor, Sheikh Fayyad al-Akbar, charges that he and others have been replaced, in his words, by people close to Fatah, who were ordered to recognize the faction as the sole authority in the PLO, although Hamas won legislative elections a year and a half ago. Muslim clerics opposing a plan by the Western Wall Heritage Foundation to build a tunnel connecting the Western Wall of the Temple in Jerusalem with the Ohel Yitzhak Synagogue in the Muslim quarter of the Old City. They charge that the foundation intends to use underground digging to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Temple Mount, even though the proposed digging is to take place more than 100 yards from the Temple Mount. The Ohel Yitzhak Synagogue was abandoned during the Arab riots in 1936 and later was blown up by Jordanian forces in their conquest of the Jewish quarter in the War of Independence in 1948. The website of the Al Jazeera news channel, quoting Israeli and Arab sources, is saying September's alleged attack on an alleged Syrian nuclear site was carried out by United States warplanes, which used many nuclear bombs to destroy the unfinished facility without killing any people. Israeli Air Force jets only provided cover for the U.S. jets, according to this version of the event. Previous reports have said that the raid was carried out by Israel, or that U.S. jets provided cover for the Israeli fighters. Rani Rahav, a leading Israeli public relations man who has devoted himself to furthering the legacy of Yitzhak Rabin, filing an urgent petition to the High Court Friday against the decision to allow the Brit ritual circumcision ceremony for the son of Rabin's assassin in Rimonim jail on Sunday. The petition claims that the ceremony will be, in effect, a publicly funded party, even though prison services officials announced that they would not allow prison, in their words, to become an events hall for the murderer of the prime minister. Only 15 people allowed to participate in the ceremony. Attorney General Menachem Mazuz drawing criticism for not appealing the ruling by Justice Tzvi Gorfinkel of the Tel Aviv District Court, who criticized prosecutors for being against Yigal Amir's marriage to Larissa Trimbobler, against her pregnancy, and in Gorfinkel's words, against this child. Rahav also claims that Amir's paternity of the baby is in doubt. Sunday marks the 12th anniversary of the assassination. According to the Jerusalem Post, a group of 30 Jewish and non-Jewish doctors from the United States and Canada have come to Israel for a 5-day course in trauma medicine and emergency preparedness. The doctors hope to learn how to best help Israel in a future emergency or war by replacing local doctors, as Army doctors are called to reserve duty. They will also learn about emergency preparedness planning and use their knowledge after returning to America. The group will practice responding to simulated emergency situations in Tel HaShomer Hospital near Tel Aviv and will also visit Sderot. Americans turning their clocks back to standard time at 2 a.m. Sunday morning, returning to the 7-hour difference in the clocks between the East Coast and Israel. Consult the homepage of IsraelNationalRadio.com for starting times of your favorite programs. Shabbat is Kaf Beta, the 22nd of Cheshvan on the Jewish calendar, and the weather forecast clear to partly cloudy with no significant change in temperature Friday, slightly cooler on Shabbat, fair on Sunday with temperatures rising on Monday. In Jerusalem and Tel Aviv on Friday, a high temperature of 26 degrees centigrade, 79 Fahrenheit. At the Red Sea, 32 degrees centigrade, 90 Fahrenheit. The Dead Sea, 30 degrees centigrade, 86 Fahrenheit. The Golan Heights, 27 degrees centigrade, 81 Fahrenheit. Ernie Singer, Israel National Radio.
That was a look at Jerusalem weather, and now for your local weather, here's meteorologist Glenn Foxen.
We see on the weather map that a high-pressure system will be in control of Pittsburgh weather in the short term. Northwesterly winds blowing around the high-pressure system will bring in dry air and cool air from Canada. So the forecast for Pittsburgh and vicinity is for fair skies and cool temperatures on Shabbos Day through Monday. Expect daytime high temperatures in the 50s and nighttime low temperatures around 40. Looking further ahead, the computer models push another stronger cold front through the region on Tuesday night. This system is forecasted to bring cold air and precipitation to the Pittsburgh area on Tuesday and Wednesday. From a climatology point of view, the precipitation will likely be in the form of rain. However, I wouldn't be surprised to see some wet snowflakes mix in with the rain showers, especially north of Pittsburgh. Wishing everyone good weather and a great Shabbos. This is meteorologist Glenn Foxen.
We want to wish our brothers and sisters in the Holy Land a very peaceful and restful Shabbat.
A lot of great music for the Mazel Tovs this week, but no Mazel Tovs to follow. At least we don't have any called in as of showtime. Keep in mind, if you have Mazel Tovs and you want to share them with the community, because the Simcha shared is the Simcha enjoyed. So give us a call each week. You can actually call now by Wednesday at 5, and we'll get it on the program for you. So you have to call it in if you want to hear it on the air. But we do have a lot of events, of course, to bring to you. New class on Israel, Spirit of the Land, Why We All Care About Israel, begins this week in 5 locations. Squirrel Hill, Shadyside, Downtown, South Hills, and Fox Chapel. You can visit myjli.com for more information, or you can call 412-421-3561. That's myjli.com. And that's the Jewish Learning Institute. And also, boys, mark your calendars. Father and Son program at the Kollel will be starting again on November 10th at 7:15 p.m. More details to follow in the coming weeks. Call the Kollel for more information, 412-420-0220. And Dr. Alex Grobman, our guest this afternoon, will be speaking on Thursday, November 8th at the JCC Levinson Hall, 7 p.m. He'll speak on Lessons from Kristallnacht, International Anti-Semitism, and he just finished a book called Nations United about the United Nations' anti-Zionistic position. For more information, contact Mrs. Edie Neve at 412-421-1500. Now we got the meeting of Food Addicts and Recovery Anonymous meets at Shari Torah every Sunday evening from 7 to 8:30 p.m. The program is a recovery group for people who cannot control their eating and or their weight. And it's not for women only. Men are invited. So for more information, call Ilana at 412-422-2224. And if you'd like to have your Mazel Tovs on our program, as I mentioned earlier, call us at 412-979-5770. Or you can email jewishexperience@verizon.net by noon on Monday for this week's program. And don't forget, candlelighting time this week, 5:58 p.m. And we'd like to welcome to the microphone this afternoon Dr. Alex Grobman, who is a historian. And he's got a Ph.D. in contemporary Jewish history with a major in, of course, the Holocaust from Hebrew University in Jerusalem. President of the Brenn Institute, a think tank dealing with historical and contemporary issues affecting the Jewish community. And he established the first Holocaust Center in the U.S., which is under the auspices of the Jewish Federation of St. Louis, Missouri. He's with us today because he's going to be in Pittsburgh November 8th. At the JCC Kaufman Building, Levinson Hall, talking about Lessons from Kristallnacht, International Anti-Semitism. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, glad to have you today because, you know, there is obviously a growing anti-Semitism today for many sectors, one of them primarily being the fact that everything seems to be blamed on Israel no matter what happens. But you're going to be talking about international anti-Semitism. And I guess the first question is there such a thing as national anti-Semitism? I mean, what's the difference?
Well, I think what the difference is is that traditional anti-Semitism was the denial of the right of individual Jews to live as equal members in the society. And the new anti-Jewishness is the denial of the right of Jewish people to live as equal members in the family of nations. Basically, all that has happened is that we've moved from discrimination against the Jews as individuals to the discrimination against the Jews as a people. I think that's the best way to sum it up.
Okay, so you don't see it as a discrimination of Jews wanting their own homeland or the arrogance thereof. You don't think that causes any kind of anti-Semitism in and of itself?
Not amongst the most of the people of the world, no.
Okay.
I don't think that's the issue. I think that, as I say, the traditional anti-Semitism was denying the right of Jews, the individual Jews, to live as equal members of a society. Now it's the inability of them to accept the fact that Jewish people have a right to live as equal members in Israel.
Okay, so where are the roots of that? Where does that come from? Is it biblical in origin? I mean, do the average person on the street today that's an anti-Semite grab that some way from biblical origins?
No, I don't think that it's necessarily from biblical. I think it's simply a matter of there's anti-Semitism generally throughout the world. That's a pathological response. And then you have in Israel, the Arabs simply have never accepted the right of the Jewish people to return to their homeland.
Sure, but where is the root? Where does it start? I mean, how does it start? Is it an envy of the Jewish people? Is that where it comes from?
Well, I think there's some people who think it's envy. I think there are people who just, I think it's a pathological response.
All right, and yeah, it's
irrational. There's no justification. I mean, you can't say the Jews are this or Jews are that. Jews are a lot of different things.
Well, getting a biblical here for a minute, do you think it comes from the concept of Ishmael? I mean, do they see themselves that way? Do they feel bad about that and therefore have to even up the score for what happened to Ishmael?
No, I don't think for most of the Muslim world that's the issue. Actually, in a certain sense, it's the hatred of Jews or hatred of the Jews in Israel is a licensed grievance, which was pointed out by Bernard Lewis, who said that Arab fixation with Israel is permitted, this licensed grievance, in countries where people are becoming increasingly angry and frustrated at all the difficulties that they under which they live. There's poverty, unemployment, oppression, and having a grievance which they can express freely is an enormous psychological advantage for them.
Sure, but why does it always end up to Jews? Why can't you pick another minority, anti-Slavic bias or something like that? Why does it seem to always end up coming into the concept of the Jews? Is it because the Jews are, winning more Nobel Prizes?
In Israel, I think the issue is because we happen to be living in that area, part of the world, with them. The anti-Semitism in general, as I say, it's justified for many reasons. So you said envy, it's the hatred of the other. We're different in many different ways, although that's changing in the Western world. We're becoming much like the other people.
Right.
But you don't want to blame the victim. You want to understand what the reality is for these other people, and we become a scapegoat in many respects for them.
Yeah, that's true. So, talking about now, moving to your topic that you're coming in here, lessons from Kristallnacht, what are some of the lessons from there? I mean, that obviously started out as a concept in the beginning of simple anti-Semitism and blew up into obviously a very tremendously historical, sad Holocaust. So how did that generate, and how do we respond to it?
Well, first of all, the Nazis saw the Jews as a cancer, and what do you do with a cancer? They said with vermin and bacilli, one does not negotiate. For their purposes, the only way that they could deal with this real problem, that was going to either destroy them or the Jews would destroy, Jews would either destroy the Germans or they had to fight back. And so from their perspective, there was no alternative.
So, do you think it's because the Jews were basically self-sustaining? Like, in other words, they used their own communities, their own people, their own customs, their own ways, and didn't get involved? Or do you think it's because the Jews left that concept of the shtetl and tried to mainstream themselves into German life that was the cause?
Well, no, in Germany, obviously, there was a tremendous amount of assimilation. But again, this was a period of time in history when the issues of race became very important. And again, the Jew became a scapegoat on one level, and the Jew became the reason why Germany had suffered all of its defeats in World War One, and that we were an enemy within, and we were a foreign body, an alien body within the German community that had to be destroyed.
Yeah. Now, these Holocaust institutes and repositories that we have now, do we have and do we still have enough credible evidence to refute a lot of the, so to speak, garbage that's out there today? That's, I guess, is that as we move away from the Holocaust, this people like David Irving and others, they seem to grow in popularity. As far from the show, I get, and I'm sure I'm going to get it from this, a lot of emails from people that obviously claim the Holocaust never happened and so forth. Do you run into this? How do you respond to it? And after a certain period of time, there's not going to be, so to speak, the direct references, the people that have actually seen it, the witnesses are not going to be there. So we'll have the historical records, but you know, people start claiming that they've been doctored or changed. How are you going to deal with that as time goes on?
Well, we don't even have to wait until time goes on. We find that Holocaust denial is still a very important part of what we're fighting with on campuses and in the academic world all the time. The fact that there's survivors around make it a little easier, but on certain levels it really doesn't matter, because these are people who are trying to distort history. And they will tell you that survivors are simply either people who forgot what happened, have no memory, or they will show you that there are inconsistencies in their testimony, which they therefore tend to suggest proves that there was no Holocaust whatsoever. So in other words, if a man forgot that he was rounded up and taken to a concentration camp on April the 10th, 1942, and it was really April the 11th, that means that there was no Holocaust. That's what they're trying to do, and I've seen it firsthand at attempts to do that, to discredit the survivors. So that's one thing. So They will take whatever evidence we have and show that it's simply false. So, for example, if you say that there were eyewitness testimonies by SS officers, well, they'll say that they were coerced. If you say that there were pictures, well, they were doctored. You cannot discuss openly and freely with people who will not have no interest in learning the truth. They have made up their minds, and they're convinced that this is the case. Our approach has to be to people who are really interested in historical truth and really learning what's happening. And those are the people that you can really talk to.
Sure, and you don't see these movements actually getting any heavy traction, do you? I mean, they seem to be scattered about. Are they growing or are they dying?
Well, I think they're holding their own. I think that when you see they become a mass movement, that's when the problem starts in anything, whether it's anti-Semitism or Holocaust denial. That's when you see a problem. That's why you have to, the minute that you see a problem of this sort, that you see an attempt to distort it, you have to respond, because if you don't respond, there are people that assume that you don't have an answer.
That's right. Well, they say if you're quiet in the face of evil, you're actually assisting it. So,
right.
So anyway, okay. So for our audience going forward that are they're hearing this, first of all, they should try to attend this lecture that you're the keynote speaker at Thursday, November 8th at 7 p.m. at Levinson Hall, JCC Kaufman Building. That's the first thing. From that, though, what is your recommendation for the average listener, both Jew and non-Jew, to so to speak prevent this anti-Semitism from spreading? And what is the best way to combat it for the average person?
I think anti-Semitism is going to be with us for the foreseeable future, but I think we have to understand why it is a problem not only for Jews but for the rest of us, because the Jews are that canary in the miner's cap, and whatever happens to Jews ultimately happens to other people, so that they need to understand if we are attacked, it really is an attack against Western civilization by those who would like to destroy it. You see, the Jews represent democracy, free speech, freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the warnings are dismissed or ignored by a world which is unwilling to take action. So, for example, when there were airline hijackings, suicide bombings of airports, cafes, supermarkets, and other attacks against civilians, which started in Israel, which are now being used against the U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, and, of course, us on September 11th, we didn't take it seriously. We didn't respond
right.
properly. And as a result of that, the international community has not yet learned that anti-Semitism is a tool of those who want to destroy democracy.
Sure.
The more anti-Semitism is used to incite hatred against the Jews in Israel, the greater the possibility of war becoming the only means to release that loathing and rage.
Okay.
And that really is the lesson. That anti-Semitism is a danger not only to the Jews, but to anybody who values democracy.
It's a danger to ordered society. So
it's to our society, absolutely.
Right.
And the same thing with Holocaust denial. And I and Michael Shermer wrote a book called Denying History, who says the Holocaust never took place. It was published by the University of California Press. I'd also urge people to look at my new book, Nations United, How the UN Undermines Israel in the West, dealing with this whole issue of anti-Semitism today, and how the United Nations is helping
sure.
to create problems for not only Jews and the State of Israel, but for our future in this democratic country in which we live.
Okay. Well, with that, we are out of time. And I do appreciate you being with us this afternoon. And also want to remind everybody, Thursday, November 8th at Levinson Hall, JCC Kaufman Building, for 7 p.m. for Lessons from Kristallnacht, International Anti-Semitism. And I guess you'll be talking and having a copy of your book available at that time. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And again, thank you for being with us, and we'll talk to you again soon. And there's a final comment. I just want to mention that we have talked about the UN quite a bit on this program, and I think our listeners are very up on where they've been in relation to Israel, so it's kind of a sad state of affairs.
Thank you. That's why I suggest strongly that they really take a look at Nations United.
Okay. I will, I'm sure, and you'll have copies there.
The copies will be there, but they should find other venues, whether it's in a library or
Amazon, wherever.
Or Amazon, yes.
Very good. Okay, thanks again, and we'll see you, I guess, November 8th.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
Take care.
Thank you.
Now, for a look at the feminine side of things, reporting from Israel, here's Ms. Devorah DeLynn.
About 2 weeks ago, I had the privilege to visit Me'ala Samach Pela for the first time. This is the burial site of Adam and Chava, Abraham and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, and Yaakov and Leah. And, of course, Esau's head, too. Hebron itself is a beautiful city. Although it hurts me a little that there's so much dirt, soldiers, and constant pops from assorted military equipment, the air itself has changed and is saturated with holiness and purity. In this week's Torah portion, Parshas Chayei Sarah, we learn about the passing of Sarah Imenu, Sarah, our matriarch, and her subsequent burial in Hebron in Aras Machpelah. The Torah uses an interesting way to describe Hebron. It says, Kiryas Arba, which is Hebron. By the way, today Kiryat Arba and Hebron are two different cities. But back then, if they were one and the same, why does the verse deem it necessary to say both? The Kri Yakar, who I'm sure you realize by now, is one of my favorite commentaries, notes that there are actually four names for the city of Hebron. Kiryat Arba, Hebron, and two others, Eshkol and Mamre. We know that the reason the name of the city of Hebron is mentioned here is to honor the passing of Sarah, so that all posterity should know the lineage of her burial place. In truth, one of the most difficult concepts to understand is the reasons behind death. Why does a person actually have to die? Illness, age, emotional state. We've created labels to attempt to fathom the reasons behind dying, but in truth, they are merely that, labels. The Kri Yakar says that there are only four different reasons why a person may die, and they are alluded to in the four names of the city of Hebron. First, there is a death that a person might bring upon himself through his sins. This is alluded to in the name Mamre, which comes from the word mar, bitter, because a person's sins are bitter in the eyes of Hashem, and this causes the person to pass away. The second reason a person may die is because of the sins of other people. For example, sometimes a tzaddik passes away to atone for the sins of a generation. This is implied in the name Eshkol, which means bereavement or loss. Kiryat Arba refers to the third reason for death, a natural course of the body, which has simply reached the end of its ability to continue living. This is hinted to us by the word Arba, four, which refers to the Kabbalistic idea that there are four foundations upon which a person resides, and when these foundations separate, the person passes away. The last and final reason a person may die is from something called Nisat Nishika, which literally means death from the kiss. Certain tzaddikim are on such a high level that they deserve to die in a special way. Hashem simply takes their soul away, and the body remains harmed and untouched, fit for burial. We know that Aaron HaKohen, Moshe Rabbeinu's brother, merited to pass away like this, as did Moshe. This unique type of passing is hinted to in the name Hebron, which comes from the root chibor, or love, because Hashem only does this out of pure love for his tzaddikim. We can now understand why the Torah used both Kiryat Arba and Hebron when explaining where Sarah passed away. Yes, Sarah passed away because of natural causes. She was 127 years old, and her body had finished its job. However, her soul itself merited to ascend in purity and holiness through the Misat Nishika, leaving her physical body untouched and ready for burial in Aras HaMachpelah. Have a good Shabbos.
Now it's time for another classic story from our master storyteller, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser.
The Yid HaKadosh, the great tzaddik, was once learning with his Talmidim, his students, when one of these students raised a very difficult question. The Yid HaKadosh began thinking of the answer. His students were aware that when a difficult question was presented to the Yid HaKadosh, he would sit and think very deeply until he came upon the answer. One of the students who were waiting while the Yid HaKadosh was thinking of an answer, who was very, very hungry, decided that he would run home for a quick bite and come back. He felt that he would be able to come back to the Beis Medrash before the Yid HaKadosh was ready with the answer. As he came home and had his lunch quickly, his mother asked him if he could go to the attic to get her something that was there. He excused himself very politely and said to his mother that he was sure that soon the class would continue, and he didn't want to miss. The boy began walking to shul when he thought to himself, "Wait a moment. I study Torah the whole day and learn how to perform mitzvos. And here, a mitzvah came to my hand. My mother asked me to help her, and I declined. I told her that I had to go back to learn Torah." With this, he turned around, went back home, and helped his mother. Upon his return to the Beis Medrash, as he was walking in the door, the Yid HaKadosh stood up. When the Yid HaKadosh stood up, all of the students stood up as well. The Yid HaKadosh explained to the class the answer to the boy's difficult question. And then he asked everyone to sit down. He said that Abaye was born as an orphan. His father passed away when his mother was pregnant, and his mother passed away at childbirth. The question is then, how does Abaye fulfill the mitzvah of honoring one's parents? He never had any parents. The answer is, whenever a person fulfills the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim, honoring their parents with sincerity, the great Torah sage Abaye accompanies them. In this way, he fulfills the mitzvah of honoring parents. The Yid HaKadosh turned then to the boy and said, "When you went back home to help your mother, Abaye accompanied you. And since you were coming to the Beis Medrash, Abaye accompanied you here as well. That is the reason I stood up, because I was able to see Abaye with you. And it was Abaye who gave me the answer to the difficult question." This is Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, wishing you all a good Shabbos.
As we wrap up another Mar Cheshvan edition of the Jewish Experience radio program, a couple of events to remind you. A new class on Israel, Spirit of the Land, Why We All Care About Israel, begins this week in five locations. Call 412-421-3561 or visit myjli.com. Sure. And boys, mark your calendars, Father and Son program at the Kollel. Call the Kollel at 412-420-0220. It's going to be starting again November 10th. Dr. Alex Grubman will be speaking Thursday, November 8th at JCC Levinson Hall at 7 p.m. Lessons from Kristallnacht, International Anti-Semitism. Call Miss Edie Neve, 412-421-1500. And also, the Meeting of Food Addicts and Recovery Anonymous, Shari Torah, Sunday evening, 7 to 8:30 p.m. Call Ilana for more information on that, 412-422-2224. Don't forget, you want to have your mouth stuffs on our program, give us a call, 412-979-5770, or you can email jewishexperience@verizon.net by noon on Monday for that week's program. And we'd like to thank Dr. Alex Grobman, who's going to be our speaker coming in November 8th, historian and author, for his keen insight in international anti-Semitism. And, you know, it was something to really understand, because a lot of people have a crazy idea of what anti-Semitism really is, and that's unfortunate. So hopefully you cleared a little bit of that up for us. Also, we'd like to thank our faithful and cutting-edge staff, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, Rabbi Yosef Eisen, MusicalMoist.com, Dr. Michael Shulman, Ms. Devorah DeLynn, and, of course, she's reporting from Israel, and our engineer, Jeremy LeBostenstein, for another outstanding show. And don't forget, candlelighting time this week, 5:58 p.m. It's been a ton of fun, but I got to run. I'm Hirsch DeLynn. See you all next week. Same Yiddish time, same Yiddish channel. Shalom.